You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
Senior Vice President of the Middle East Institute, and I would like to invite, welcome you to today's book talk and signing, Magnificent Delusions, Pakistan, the United States, and an Epic History of Misunderstanding with Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, former Pakistani ambassador to Washington. We are originally supposed to hold this event in January, but two snowstorms later, we're finally holding it in May, so I want to thank you for your patience and perseverance. It's a great treat and honor to have you here. I should note that he will be signing his books afterwards here in the front. The books are being sold for $25, so please line up and buy a book. Here at MEI, we've had the good fortune to be able to program in a sustained way on Pakistan and Afghanistan through our Center for Pakistan Studies run by Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. These are two countries with very complex political environments and very complex political relationships with the United States. So the more we can talk about them and discuss them, especially and hear other perspectives, especially insider perspectives, the better off we all are. And that is why MEI is so appreciative of Lewis R. Hughes, a board member who has contributed to make this series of panels possible. So before we begin today's talk with Ambassador Haqqani, I just want to thank Lewis Hughes for his support of MEI. And now I'd like to hand the show over to our moderator, Marvin Weinbaum.
Thank you, Kate. Kate has really taken away the thunder from my introduction, because I was going to talk about perseverance. She's already thanked our speaker for his willingness to come back yet another time and schedule yet another time. But I also want to thank you people too, because you've been offered the opportunity to hear him twice before, and we have canceled on you. So, because of snow, of course, we would need something catastrophic to cancel here. Yes, you've had, Ambassador Haqqani has spoken elsewhere, and some of you have heard him elsewhere, and I understand some of you have come back because you want to hear him still again. So, welcome here. And I'm delighted to be able to introduce someone who I've known for quite a while now. Known him both as, of course, when he was ambassador here, but also as a scholar. And it's really in that vein, and he is a scholar, has produced two very scholarly books, one on the Pakistan military, and then this latest one on, which you have here, on U.S.-Pakistani relations, but has scholarly credentials in that as some of you, many of you know, he is a professor at Boston University and directs a program there. So we have here that combination, which is not unknown in this town, of the scholar diplomat. And I don't know anybody who epitomizes it better than Hussein Haqqani. So let's welcome him and his remarks. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marvin, for those very kind remarks. They used to say about postmen that neither hail nor snow nor rain shall stop them from doing their daily rounds. And in this case, snow stopped us from having the event, but not from me delivering the message, albeit a little late. May is a much better time for people to reflect on things anyway. Let me begin by saying that the very fact that we are having an event at the Middle East Institute on a country that is actually not located in the Middle East shows the complexities of Pakistan. From 1947, there has been a tendency in the United States to think of Pakistan as a Middle Eastern country. Historically, geographically, culturally, Pakistan is part of South Asia. For a long time, of course, the State Department always had the concept of NISA, Near East and South Asia, like as one region. But the regions are very distinct. In case of Pakistan, one of the biggest problems, in my humble opinion, has been Pakistan's desire to be a Middle Eastern country, a kind of a Middle Eastern wannabe. We don't speak any of the Middle Eastern languages. We don't speak Persian. We don't speak Turkish. We don't speak Arabic. The languages we do speak, for example, Sindhi, if there are other Sindhi speakers, they are in India, not in the Middle East. If there are other Punjabi speakers, they are in India, not in the Middle East. If there are other Pashto speakers, they are in Afghanistan, not in the Middle East. And Urdu, which is Pakistan's national language, even though it is the mother tongue of a very small minority of Pakistanis, that language, of course, its major centers of origin and cultural evolution and development are all now in India. So this is has been one of the major focuses of my study since the beginning. Even while serving in government, I've always made an argument that Pakistan sometimes needs to revisit its national narrative. Pakistan has built a national narrative which essentially is not rooted in history. It's rooted in fantasy. And when I thought of the title for this book, I came up with the title Magnificent Delusions for that very reason. Among the various fantasies in Pakistan is this whole idea that Pakistan is the homeland of Muslims of South Asia, which is what it was conceived as. But the truth now is that the Muslims of South Asia live in significant numbers in three countries, Bangladesh, India, and Pakistan. And if you look at absolute numbers, there are more Muslims in Bangladesh and India than there are in Pakistan. So the whole raison d'etre debate in Pakistan, which continues even though my argument is, as a Pakistani who was born in Pakistan, I'm a born Pakistani. I was born many years after partition. For me, partition is a historic event. I'm willing to look at it as a historic event. I'm willing to analyze it as a historic event. But I'm not going to get into arguments. Had I been there as an adult in 1945, 46, I would have participated in the arguments. I may have had arguments about, you know, should be, shouldn't be, etc., etc. But now, I'm born a Pakistani, and by the way, according to demographic studies, 85% of Pakistanis are born post-partition. Of the current Pakistan. So Pakistan needs to transcend this argument about its raison d'etre and just become a functional state. That was the bottom line in my first book. That, in a way, is the bottom line in this book as well. And the reason why I have looked at the U.S.-Pakistan relationship in great detail, and in this book in particular, I have gone through the American archives. Now, people say, well, you're a Pakistani, you served as Pakistan's ambassador, and you're trying to explain U.S.-Pakistan relationship through American archives. My answer is that, look, these archives are primarily records of meetings. And the only ones who are declassifying them right now are the Americans. Pakistan does not have a policy of declassifying anything. And so, therefore, Pakistani records are not easily accessible except those of those events where I was a participant myself. So the whole premise of the book is that the U.S.-Pakistan relationship was based essentially on false pretenses. In 1947, Pakistan started out with a major disadvantage. The disadvantage was it was the new country. It was a new country that had the enthusiasm of its population, an enthusiasm that really appealed to American diplomats who arrived in Karachi because they really liked the idea of these young people, or for that matter, even elderly people, wanting to start a new country, sitting on soap boxes instead of tables, sort of sharing pencils, trying to build together a government. And you find that in the early cables, that the American diplomats really liked the Pakistanis. By the way, the Pakistanis are a wonderful people. I mean, you know, almost everyone in this room, if you're not a Pakistani yourself, you know somebody who's a Pakistani. Extremely charming, very hospitable, warm people. This is not about the Pakistani people. This is not about the Pakistani doctor or the dentist that you know. This is not about the Pakistani friend that you have or you went to college with. This is about the Pakistani state. And how did the Pakistani state start out? It started out with 33% of British India's army, one-third, and only 17% of its revenue sources. Big mismatch to start with. Second, the army was not raised for any threat that Pakistan faced. It wasn't even raised for Pakistan. It was raised for the British Empire. And so the new nation state never got a chance of figuring out what the army would be for, what is the purpose. It already had an army. In its initial years, it was led by British officers until 1951. The commander-in-chief of the Pakistani army was British. The head of the ISI, when the ISI was formed in 1948, was Major General Robert Cawthorn, a British Army officer of Australian origin, who, by the way, to this day, has the distinction of being the longest serving head of the ISI. And so here were these British officers who were still thinking in terms of the Raj, except that, you know, they thought, oh, the Indians have expelled us, but the Pakistanis haven't. And they were instrumental in actually persuading the Americans in becoming allies of Pakistan. What was Pakistan's need for becoming America's ally? And that is something that is in my book. I don't want to give the whole book away because I hope some of you will buy it. Because it's always a good idea to buy books to help the authors who occasionally tend to benefit somewhat from whatever you pay for the book. The Pakistani founding fathers didn't look at this as a serious mismatch and a problem to deal with. They instead, in the first Pakistani budget, allocated 80% of Pakistan's government resources to paying the military. They did not think of, you know, maybe we need to decommission parts of this military. We can't afford it. And instead they said, we will become useful for Uncle Sam, who needs us for the war against communism, except we don't intend to fight it. So since then, this was like a game in which the Pakistanis were offering Pakistan services in the war against the Soviet Union and against communism. And the truth is that the very first time that the subject came up, 1949-50, the Korean War, the Pakistani response was, absolutely, we'll give you troops to fight in Korea, but only after you equip and pay for our troops, and B, you help us in our problems with India, and C, you get Kashmir for us. So since the very foundations, these issues have been there in the U.S.-Pakistani relationship. Why do I call it a delusion? Well, it was a delusion on the part of Pakistan to think that America, who at that time wanted India as its ally as well, and turned to Pakistan only after being disappointed by India, because India decided on non-alignment, that the United States will basically put all its weight behind Pakistan and help Pakistan secure Kashmir or military parity with India. First of all, the very notion that Pakistan could have military parity with India was, in my opinion, not rationally founded. India was much larger. It had much more resources. And it had a historic continuity. Pakistan was the new country. It needed to consolidate itself politically and economically. But instead of doing that, Pakistan's leaders decided that they will play global power games and thereby get the equipment and the resources and the money to keep building our military. That had many consequences for Pakistan's domestic politics. I've spoken about them in my first book, Pakistan Between Mosque and Military. By the way, you can order both books on Amazon.com. I'm sure they'll throw in free shipping and handling if you want. But the biggest consequence of it was that the military started playing an outsized role in Pakistan's affairs. By 1958, it had taken over. General Ayub Khan had become Pakistan's president. But before that, the Truman administration was very reluctant to sign on Pakistan as an ally. They didn't want to get on. Dean Acheson said, if the price of having Pakistan as a military ally is having to turn on India and to get involved with India-Pakistan sort of tensions, it's not worth it. But then came Mr. John Foster Dulles. Now, Mr. Dulles, as we all know, was a man who believed, had very strong beliefs in right and wrong, good and bad. And he also had another problem, which was that his enthusiasm was only matched by his ignorance of the world. There's a famous incident, which I have repeated many times in my presentations, and I will do it again because it's just so amusing and it's so telling. He, after being turned down by India to become an ally in his ring of alliances around the Soviet Union and around the Communist bloc, signed up Pakistan as a member of the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. Now, talk about geographic confusion. I mean, even East Pakistan was not in Southeast Asia. What is today Bangladesh is a little distant from Vietnam and Indochina and wherever the action was at that time. So once Pakistan became a member of SEATO, Mr. Dulles came back to Washington and ran into Walter Lippmann. the columnist, who berated him for making this error of signing up Pakistan as a member of SEATO. And Mr. Dulles turned around and said, look here, Walter, I have been told by the British that there are martial races in India, in the subcontinent, and there are not martial people. And the only people who know how to fight in the south of Asia are the Gurkhas. That is why I have signed on Pakistanis as allies. Lipman turned around and said, Foster, the Gurkhas are not Pakistani. Dulles turned around and said, really? Well, at least they are Muslim. To which, of course, Lipman responded, no, they're not. They're Hindus. Now, for a man who had served as senator from Virginia and was going to lead the free world into this huge crusade against communism, to actually not know that the people he was signing on as allies for being this great warrior nation were neither Gurkhas, and that the the Gurkhas were not Muslim, may have been shocking, but it didn't stop him. And by 1957, President Eisenhower was questioning Dulles' wisdom himself. He was saying, why are we spending so much money in equipping and arming Pakistan? Pakistan refuses to give a single troop to fight in Korea or anywhere else. But Pakistan did provide a National Security Agency, CIA, listening post up in Peshawar, from where U-2 flights started. That didn't come to a very good result as well. The very first major U-2 flight to take off from Peshawar actually was shot down. Francis Gary Powers, which revealed the whole program. So Pakistan ended up having to face a Soviet threat. Even before, as early as 48, 49, the Soviets actually had no real design on Pakistan. In fact, they didn't even establish diplomatic relations. They didn't recognize Pakistan in its first few months. They just had no interest. So, again, this was like a fantasy coupled with a delusion. That the fantasy on the part of Pakistan that, you know what, the Soviets are coveting us, we are aligning with the Americans. But the real problem, the real thing always was, and there are documents in this that are cited, some rare Pakistani documents as well, which one got hold of through the help of colleague Shuja Nawaz, who's at the Atlantic Council, who has written a very good book on the Pakistan Army, wherein the Pakistanis are clearly coming to the Americans and among themselves strategizing and saying, don't mention India. The Americans won't give us arms if we say we need those arms against India. But knowing fully well that the arms they were getting were going to be for India. In 1965, Pakistan started the 1965 war, which, of course, resulted in America turning off the tap. Lyndon Johnson got very upset. And that was the first time that this little bonhomie ended and the Pakistanis started demonstrating against America, protests, widespread, and this narrative started that the Americans are fickle friends. The truth of the matter was that if you look at it from both sides, Pakistan was rightly disappointed. It was in the middle of a war, and Americans were turning off military supplies. But from the American point of view, this was a war that Pakistan should not have started, because very clear in the SEATO agreement and subsequent bilateral agreements on defense between Pakistan and India was a exclusion treaty, which said, an exclusion clause which said the U.S.-Pakistan military alliance is only for in case of communist aggression. The question is, if the American calculus was that the communists are not about to invade Pakistan, then why were they continuing to arm the Pakistani military? Again, My term of delusion applies. The American expectation was that if we just arm them enough and give them enough money and make them feel secure about India, then Pakistan's military will be available to us for the Middle East and the Southeast Asian theaters of any conflicts that might emerge with the communists. Further down, of course, there was the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan. There, too, there's a slight difference in the Pakistani narrative and the real history. The Pakistanis were playing a role in Afghanistan long before the Soviets came in, and that is something people forget. And then when the Soviets came, there was the jihad. Americans thought they were fighting Charlie Wilson's war. Pakistanis were fighting General Ziaul Haq's war, two totally different wars, even though both were being funded by the same sources. And the consequence was that Pakistan became the epicenter of global jihad that unfortunately harmed Pakistan much more than it harmed any other nation. Pakistan's military and intelligence services have a very specific view of how they view the region. They want to secure Pakistan's interests in Afghanistan by having a regime there that is friendly and sympathetic to Pakistan. They want to be perceived as India's equal, and they want to secure Kashmir, which most Pakistanis, including myself, feel was wrongfully taken away from Pakistan as and should have been part of Pakistan at the time of partition. So that's where things stand. Why do I call it a delusion? Of course, there's stories about the period when I served and coming all the way to finding of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. My basic contention is that the Pakistani national interest, now I have a very different definition of Pakistani national interest, but unfortunately my definition of Pakistani national interest does not count. It does not count because Pakistan has this tradition of declaring anybody who does not agree with the military-defined paradigm of national interest as a traitor. Goes back all the way to Hussein Shahid Suharwardi, who in the 1950s said Pakistan should declare itself a secular state. You know, goes back to Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who was declared a traitor for signing the Simla Accord because he thought that, you know, that was the only way forward. Goes back to Benazir Bhutto, who was called a national security risk in the 1990s, early 1990s, for having a different paradigm. And so therefore my view is also in the same category. What is my view? I think Pakistan needs to look inward. In 1947, what is today Pakistan had a literacy rate of 16%. What is today India had a literacy rate of 18%. After $40 billion of American economic and military assistance since 1948, Pakistan has a literacy rate hovering around 52-54%. India has a literacy rate of 75%. The 2% difference has become a 20% difference. 42% of school-going age children, children between the age of 5 and 15 in Pakistan, and Pakistan has a very young population. Median age is 21, which means half of the 180 million people are below the age of 21. 42% of school-going age children don't go to any school. Then you have the madrasas. The madrasas don't have that many students, by the way, in absolute numbers, but they are a problem because of the worldview they present. Then, not only that, the regular schools also are creating a problem. The vice chancellor of Punjab University is Dr. Mujahid Kamran, a physics PhD. He has a physics PhD from Europe, somewhere in Europe, and he also came to the United States as a Fulbright scholar. So obviously in his discipline, which is physics, he's quite a scholar. But he's written a book recently which says that 9/11 was an inside job perpetrated by the Americans to justify American invasion of Muslim lands. But he doesn't stop there only. He goes further. He says Britain and the United States are controlled by a cabal of, are run by a cabal of bankers, which by the way is a term out of Mein Kampf. You know what the allusion is to. And he says they control people within Muslim countries who express pro-American, pro-Western views, obviously a reference to people like myself, by putting microchips in their heads. Now, he's a physicist. He should understand the value of empiricism. He should say, okay, let's open Haqqani's head and find a Hussein Haqqani's head, not Jalaluddin's, and find the microchip. I mean, these are verifiable things, but he doesn't go there. So my thing is that Pakistan has a problem even with those who are, first of all, 42% are not going to any school. School enrollment is the lowest in South Asia, lower than India, lower than Bangladesh, lower than Sri Lanka. But even those who are going to school are being fed this conspiracy theory nonsense in the name of the ideology of Pakistan. There was, of course, you've all heard about him, Dr. Bashiruddin Mahmood, who at one point headed Pakistan's nuclear program. He's also a famous physicist, nuclear physicist at that. And at one point, he kind of rediscovered or discovered religion and wrote a paper that he called an academic paper in which he argued that since the Quran mentions beings made of fire called genies, all we need to do is pray hard enough to make sure that we can capture the genies and use them to solve the world's energy problem. Why do these things worry me? What worries me about Dr. Kamran is not that he said it. There are crazy kooks everywhere. There may be people here, academics, who say unusual things. But if a head of an American university said that kind of crazy thing. He wouldn't be in the job the next day. And within an hour of him saying that on national television, one of his children would go and say, "Daddy, you need to see a psychiatrist." But that is not the case in Pakistan. That worries me about Pakistan. And that is why I say that the delusion of Pakistan wanting to be a great power, punching beyond its weight class, trying to be a regional power without feeding its own people, without putting its children into school, is a delusion. But the national interest as defined by Pakistan's powers that be remains seeking parity with India, pursuit of Kashmir, and pursuit of securing strategic depth in Afghanistan. Pakistan is, for example, again, considering playing a role in the Middle East, in Syria, on behest of the Saudis, in return for Saudi money and possibly support in buying arms on the international market. That is not a recipe for Pakistan's progress. However, I think it is a delusion on the part of Pakistan that with all these exertions, Pakistan will be able to achieve that particular definition of national interest. Look, the size difference between India and Pakistan is even bigger than the size difference between Belgium and France. If Belgium made it its raison d'etre that all it will do is compete with France for the rest of its life, boy, the Belgians will have to make a whole lot more chocolate before they can actually compete with France. And so, the U.S.-Pakistan relationship has a fundamental weakness, and that fundamental weakness is that the American interest and the Pakistani interest as defined by Pakistan's establishment just do not coincide. Americans can regret that, you know, they keep giving aid and they still can't get influence in Pakistan. That is because you're asking Pakistan's establishment to go against what they deem to be their national interest. You say, go against the jihadis. If they think that the jihadis are their allies for regional influence, why would they go against them? And so this assumption that's just pouring in aid is a way to get another country to act in ways that its leaders do not consider national interest is, in my opinion, a delusion. And that's the history that this book traces. On the part of Pakistan, I think there's another delusion, and that's even bigger. That delusion is that Pakistan is so important to the United States that the United States will endlessly support Pakistan economically and militarily, irrespective of what Pakistan does at home. Several times the Americans, of course, have, in my opinion, wrongly broken the relationship or backed away from the relationship. And, you know, it's understandable because in the real world, there are no permanent friends and permanent enemies. But Pakistan wants both permanent friends and a permanent enemy. India is the permanent enemy, and America and China should be permanent friends. China is a friend, but that's because Chinese are very different from the Americans. America is a unique country. Here, when you say that's history, what you really mean is that's irrelevant. In China, everything is about history. In America, when you're making a 5-year plan, you say, I'm making a long-term plan. In China, when you're talking about the next 500 years, you say, we are thinking short-term here. So these are two different countries. But the truth is, Pakistan is the youngest country in South Asia. It's 67 years old. There's no use pretending that, you know, there's been a Pakistan for 1,000 years, because there hasn't. Muhammad bin Qasim couldn't have pronounced the word Pakistan because Arabs don't pronounce P. You know? this fantasy of fabricating history has been a major Pakistani delusion, and that has come up against the American delusion of being able to, quote-unquote, buy off Pakistan away from its own self-interest as its leaders perceive. Where do I see the relationship going next? I could actually end this by saying, you know, read that in the book. But since I owe it to Wendy and Marvin, I will give a short comment on that too. I think that the United States and Pakistan should continue to engage, but they must engage on a more realistic basis instead of on the basis of these of fantasies about each other. Pakistan must stop expecting that the Americans will back Pakistan in becoming the regional power that Pakistanis dream to be. Americans must understand that their idea that somehow Admiral Mullen will go to Pakistan 26 times and spend almost 100 hours with General Kiani, and then General Kiani will miraculously turn the ship of state around, is also unrealistic. Similarly, if the only institution in Pakistan that will receive large amounts of assistance will be the Pakistani military, then the Pakistani military's self-view and its view of the world will continue to prevail in Pakistan. Pakistan needs to have an open debate, a more honest debate about what our options are. Pakistan needs a more honest debate, which is what I'm trying to push for as a Pakistani. We need to have a more honest debate about what is our national interest. Is this really our national interest? Is Pakistan really, should Pakistan really be all about trying to change the regional status quo, or should we actually reconcile to the regional status quo and in the process strengthen ourselves economically, bring ourselves to a level where we can actually act as a significant power? Pakistan has a strong military. It's the sixth largest military in the world, I think. It also has one of the largest nuclear arsenals. But we also have a very large population that lives below the poverty line. Our economy is very anemic. We are growing at 2.5-3% per annum, which is very low for that region. We are not producing the skilled manpower that we should, which we could, and that skilled manpower could actually dominate the entire region. And worst of all, we are not doing anything about jihadi extremism, which now has become intertwined with hyper-Pakistani nationalism. There are individuals in Pakistan who are not jihadists. They are not Islamic fundamentalists. I would name a certain cricketer, a former cricketer if I could, but I don't take, people's names unnecessarily. I mean, he's not a mullah. He's not really, but his whole national, narrative is the same as that of the Islamic parties. The new controversy that we are having over this between a Pakistani media group and the ISI, again, who's demonstrating in favor of the ISI? It's not mainstream political parties. It's not civil society. It's the Islamist extremist groups. Why? Because they share a worldview and a regional view. And that is problematic for Pakistan, because the Pakistani government should have a 21st century vision. It should not be partners with people whose vision for Pakistan is creating an 8th century enclave. You know, we already saw what values the Taliban represent. They don't want little girls to go to school. Pakistan needs little girls to go to school. Pakistan needs its women to be educated and equal partners in economic and progress and the march forward. So the American role in Pakistan, in my opinion, should be, if any, it should be to help Pakistan have a robust debate about its national interest and get away from the trap that Pakistan is falling in, which is of hyper-nationalism and a religion-based national identity that is only harming us and creating greater friction between our various ethnic groups. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a summary of this book, which I hope all of you will buy and read. Thank you all very much.
Before we proceed with having questions, I must come to MEI's defense, because Hussein started off by suggesting perhaps that we were stretching it a bit by having a discussion here today on Pakistan. But let me remind the audience that when Pakistan was created, the Middle East Journal decided that Pakistan and Afghanistan were part of the Middle East. And so its definition of the Middle East for these 67 years has always included it. 40 years ago, I wrote an article which its title was "Pakistan Enters the Middle East." Apana Pandey sitting here has a wonderful book, a student of Hussein Haqqani at Boston University, on why Pakistan has tried to escape from South Asia because it thinks that it can get a better deal in the Middle East. And in this issue of the Middle East Journal, there is an article on Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. So in defense of MEI and some of us else here, we're not stretching at all.
No, Marvin, no defense necessary. It's perfectly understandable. If somebody wants to locate themselves in the Middle East, those studying it will have to study it in the context of the Middle East. So there was no criticism intended of the Middle East Institute. It was a critique of Pakistan's attempts to try and redefine itself.
Yes.
Pakistanis don't eat falafel on a daily basis. They eat curry and chapati, you know. So when you try to redefine yourself and you can relocate yourself, sort of intellectually wherever you like, but unfortunate for Pakistan, our attempts to relocate ourselves have always been, we've always compared ourselves with Europe or America. Even our export policies, I mean, you look at it, we would be able to sell much more goods to the region. We are one of the few countries in the world whose export sort of, you know, policy is essentially to try and export farther and farther away. We are looking for markets in Latin America instead of in our neighborhood. Whereas, you know, any economist will tell you it's much cheaper, much easier to sell next door. So that was the point. It was a critique of that. Certainly not
what
of my
defense.
Hosts.
What a defense.
Certainly not of my hosts.
Okay. All right. Then, Wendy, please.
Thank you very much. Wendy Chamberlain of the Middle East Institute. Hussein, your last piece of advice to the United States in what can the United States do for Pakistan was to encourage the Pakistanis to have an internal debate about their own vision for the future. What if I said that that might be a delusion on our part? Should we try to do that? That kind of a question ought to be among Pakistanis sure. themselves. Now, my question then is, what would the Pakistani reaction be if we did sort of pull back a little bit, not cut relationships, because I don't think we want to and certainly won't want to, but just lower the temperature, stop telling Pakistan what to do, stop pretending that our aid is a lever to do that, what would the Pakistani reaction be? Because I'm afraid that reaction might be one of offense.
Well, look, I mean, Pakistan has taken offense on everything you've ever done anyway. 83% after $40 billion, if you were trying to win a popularity contest, you badly lost and badly lost money. You've given $40 billion in bilateral assistance, just bilateral assistance. If we throw in all the money that Pakistan has received from the World Bank, the IMF, and the Asian Development Bank as a result of your intervention, then that runs into even more billions. And what are the results? 83% of Pakistanis have an unfavorable view of Pakistan, according to recent Pew polls, right? That's the highest, 83%. So, I mean, very frankly, you know, I could get that result for you for $500 million. I mean, you know, give me $500 million and I'll make sure from 83% it goes to 84%, you know, negativity. So it's an absolute waste. The problem lies in a presumption, and this is not a critique of American diplomacy at all, but an observation. There is a presumption sometimes that, you know, we have no option. My theory is that whenever somebody believes we have no option, that actually limits your option. So throughout the time, the assumption that, you know, aid gives us leverage, even though there is no empirical evidence of it, has caused a lot of problems. I think you should stop worrying about the reaction. Second, the Pakistani, and you should give assistance where you think is, you know, it's a matching of interests. You know, for example, if you think you're getting good results in supporting Pakistani education or healthcare, etc., go ahead with it. No one's stopping you. Your private sector investing in Pakistan, fine, but private sector invests where investment will bring a better results. Investment can't be as a result of government encouragement. I think the real problem lies in when you let the Pakistani narrative slip by without questioning it. I'll give you examples. It's taken so many years for me to sort of point out to people that you didn't desert Pakistan in 1990. Repeatedly, General Ziaul Haq assured the United States government that Pakistan would not make nuclear weapons if America continued economic assistance. The presentation that was given to Congress by Jim Buckley when he was Under Secretary of State was that we are giving Pakistan F-16 aircraft and tanks, M1 tanks and whatnot. We are giving those because once Pakistan feels secure through conventional weapons capability, it will not have the incentive to make nuclear weapons. That was the argument that was being marketed. And the Reagan administration was kind of looking the other way while Dr. A.Q. Khan was getting Pakistan's nuclear program together. Once President George H.W. Bush came into office, he just felt that he couldn't certify that Pakistan did not have a nuclear weapon when the CIA's intelligence said it did. That was the issue. But the Pakistani response was, we came out on the streets, we burnt your flags, we shouted. I think Richard McKee, who's sitting there, was Consul General in Lahore when some of that was happening. And you guys kind of panicked, and then you kept... The sanctions that were to be triggered were not fully triggered. The truth is, you kept things going for several years. Well, until 1993-94, the aid continued to flow. But official after official comes to Washington, D.C., gives that little edited narrative, you know, you deserted us, you were dishonored, you know, da-da-da, and you guys don't confront them. All I'm asking for is a little more honesty on both sides. We will find a middle ground when both sides are willing to accept. So I'm working on the Pakistani side. I agree with you. Our narrative, our debate is ours. You know, some of us are paying a price for it too. I tell you, exile is not a good life. I'd rather be in Karachi or Islamabad. That's where my home is. That's where my family is, the extended family. And you know, we Pakistanis like our extended family. But Benazir Bhutto spent a long period in exile. You know, there are people who end up in jail. There are people who get killed. So Pakistanis are engaged in trying to have that narrative. But if America ends up supporting the wrong narrative, as you have ended up doing, by not being a little more firm in saying, no, excuse me, that's not true, then you end up feeding our wrong narrative and strengthening it further and further. That's just my observation. We can disagree on that, but that's my view. And as far as worrying about, you know, oh gosh, we'll become more unpopular, as Hillary Clinton once said, if 84% dislike us more, you know, is that going to be worse than 83% disliking us? What's the room there to maneuver? I mean, the room is very little now.
Okay. Yes, please. Please identify yourself.
Yeah, very nice talk, Mr. Haqqani. I'm Sahar Gul. I'm from Pakistan, and I'm a researcher on nationalism and extremism. And my question is that I have a couple of questions.
Just one, because we really are running out of time.
Okay. So then I have to think which question I have to ask. So, So there have been two tenures of Obama, they were Democrats, and now after that there's of course Republicans might come. So we have been seeing democracy in Pakistan, democratic relationship between Pakistan and U.S. those haven't been smooth. And when Republicans are coming in power, we have been seeing that they have been supporting extra-constitutional governments and dictatorships. So when Democrats are here and still the relationships are not smooth, when neocons are coming, how you foresee the Pak-U.S. relations?
Sir, first of all, this is an oversimplification. For example, the 1977 coup took place when Jimmy Carter was president of the United States, when General Ziaul Haq took over. I think Pakistanis need to take a deep breath and stop believing this thing that, you know, I have never found any evidence of America encouraging any coup in Pakistan ever. Ever. You know? I mean, Bill Clinton was president when Musharraf took over. You know? So they were both Democrats. These are little Pakistani myths that, you know, we are so important that somehow the American president plans, you know, which general to wink at and he will then take over power. Not true. What happens is that the military actually does present a slightly more organized government. Pakistani democracy is somewhat chaotic. Pakistan's political parties are not fully disciplined and organized. And then they also suffer from all these problems of repeated military interventions. They have to go into prison. They go underground. They suffer a lot. So therefore, and the military, of course, everybody is trained. They can come. They can deliver the talking points. The Pakistani former, I mean, usually the military appoints bureaucratic ambassadors and diplomats who are also very well trained, and they kind of go with the points. And then, you know, the civilians are a little weak in being able to do that. If we had continuous democracy for 10, 15, 20 years, maybe we will have a professional cadre of civilians tied to the political parties. But generally what happens is the military comes, there are all these guys from the World Bank and IMF who are living in Washington, D.C. They all join the government. They all have connections here. They all come and reassure everybody that, you know what, I mean, looking back at the archives, you find that's been the pattern, you know. All these good IMF, World Bank, Pakistani professionals are the ones who reassure the Americans, this time things are going to be much better. And the Americans, of course, being Americans, they always believe this time it'll be better, you know. And so that's what the military, the American propensity for accepting military governments has been. Otherwise, if you look at it, the Americans tried very hard to work with the government of Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. They had a relatively positive view. The archives show that. They were favorably disposed to Benazir Bhutto. But at the end of the day, the Americans also want decisions to be carried out. And the problem in Pakistan lies in the military often rendering the civilians incapable of fulfilling their agenda. You know, the kind of screaming you've had against the civilians in the media, for example, you never had against Musharraf. It was the same media. Only towards the end you heard the screaming. And even then, you know, you say something, I mean, you can call an ambassador a traitor, not file charges against him, but pretend that there are charges against him, and you can demand that he resign, and there's nothing wrong with it. And then somebody says, you know what, I think the DGISI was involved in trying to kill me and kill my brother, and you say, that's treason. Try it as a regular court case, as a criminal case. That doesn't happen. So you have to understand the internal dynamic of Pakistan affects this. I personally do not think that there is much appetite in Washington, D.C., in Congress, or elsewhere, for another military coup in Pakistan. Be very clear about that. Similarly, now there are laws in America that will be automatically triggered in case of a coup d'etat. Does that mean the Americans will shut their embassy and walk out? No. The Americans will engage with whoever takes power in Pakistan, lawfully or unlawfully. But I don't think that the kind of welcome Ayub Khan got, or Yahya Khan got, or Ziaul Haq got, will be repeated. Even in case of Musharraf, remember, when President Clinton stopped for 5 hours in Islamabad, he refused to have a picture taken shaking Musharraf's hand. I don't know if you remember that. And yet, what changed was 9/11. And after 9/11, again, I think the American decision was a correct one to work with Pakistan. And the working helped. America got a lot of extremists and terrorists in Pakistan, caught them. I think the mistake was that when you have a reluctant ally, you shouldn't put, I mean, look, the Americans are rather simple about how they deal with the world. They often think that, you know, when you're taking somebody out to a lunch, they're your friend. If they're not your friend and they're behaving badly, you bomb them. They don't understand that sometimes the guy who you are having lunch with is lying to you. So it took them a little while to discover that Musharraf was lying and was a lot was happening on ground that was not the behavior of an ally. I think the Americans have also become a little wiser on that score. Most of what will change in Pakistan will occur if Pakistanis change our understanding of politics. And I think we have a more complicated situation on ground than we even acknowledge. Today, the World Health Organization has announced new travel restrictions for Pakistanis over polio. Now, we could do the usual, which is demonstrations, burning World Health Organization flags and saying this is all a Indo-Zionist conspiracy, or we can face the reality that, you know what, by not letting children get polio vaccine, we have revived polio in Pakistan. We are the single largest country in terms of polio occurrence. The Pakistani strain of polio has been found in Syria because some jihadi took it there. Now it's spreading in Syria. And we need to take responsibility. So stop worrying about whether there's going to be a Republican president or a Democratic president. If you're an American national, fine, worry about it. But if you're a Pakistani, stop worrying about America. Start worrying about Pakistan.
This is Riaz Haider. Ambassador Haqqani, it's always a pleasure to listen to you. My question is, what happened to the Kerry-Loger Assistance Pact for the civil society in Pakistan?
It has been, it is ongoing. Unfortunately, for a couple of years, Pakistan has not been able, because most of it was supposed to be project aid for specific areas, $1.5 billion for 5 years. It ends in 2014. I'm not sure whether Congress will renew it. So the amounts will be a lot less in the future. If we had performed well on the five-year period, perhaps there could have been a renewal. And if we had fulfilled other criteria of bilateral relations, going after the terrorists, et cetera, which the Americans feel we haven't. So my view is that the Kerry-Loger bill was a positive bill. It helped Pakistan in many ways, but Pakistan simply could not absorb all the money because we never were able to present the effective programming for it. And so in the end, we just wanted it to be a kind of a budgetary support for us. And the tendency now, even Britain, the British Parliament has decided we'll give aid to Pakistan only if Pakistan shows a resolve to raise its own taxes, generate revenue. It can't be that external monies will just go into the kitty. If Americans want to support healthcare and education in Pakistan, it should go to healthcare and education in Pakistan. So there's still some money from the Kerry-Loger appropriations that is still in the pipeline and has not yet been delivered. Problem will come after 2014. Will it be, because it was from 2009 to 2014, to be renewed in 2014 if Congress deemed it necessary? Right now, I don't see that happening. Right now. But, you know, Congress works in its own infinite wisdom, so we don't know where it might go next.
Daniel Sirwer, I'm affiliated with Middle East Institute and with Johns Hopkins SAIS. Mr. Ambassador, as an American, when I think about Pakistan, the thing I worry about most is nuclear weapons. Both their possible use by Pakistan or by somebody against Pakistan, and the question of proliferation. What can you tell us that gives us some comfort on this front, or are we right to be very worried?
You phrase the question in a way in which actually I can turn around and say not much, because you said, can you give us comfort? And my answer is not much. Look, here's the problem. Pakistan has thought of nuclear weapons as weapons of pride and weapons of competition. The usual studies of, you know, what that'll entail, what happens if there's a nuclear exchange, what is the nuclear escalation ladder, et cetera, hasn't been given adequate thought in Pakistan. As far as the public is concerned, that's why Deq Khan became a public hero, because it was rah, 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 we got the nukes kind of thing, which is fine. But after that, a responsible government has to create an escalation ladder, at which point will we go to use the nukes. Pakistan has not renounced first use of nuclear weapons. One of the only countries with nuclear weapons capability with that policy, other than the U.S. The concerns are legitimate. That said, I would say that the way they are sometimes presented, you know, what if there are loose nukes? No, the nukes are under good command and control. What you have to worry about is the direction of the Pakistani state, not that somebody will steal the nukes and use them. That's not going to happen. It is a, you know, look, Pakistan may have a lot of problems in terms of the issues of identity, etc., as a nation. But the state of Pakistan has by and large endured, because after all, we've invested so heavily in the machinery of state, which is the military, the intelligence service. So they kind of keep the place together there. What you have to worry about is if we get into a war situation, which you did in 1999, we haven't had a repetition of that. And I think at some point, Pakistan and India need to move forward in terms of their dialogue. That is also stalled. Once that is there, then Pakistan needs to be brought under some nuclear restraint regime. It can't be the outlier all the time. India has come under a kind of a regime through the Indo-US nuclear deal. There are some restraints they have admitted. Making Pakistan into an outlaw runs the risks that you are worried about more. So you actually have to negotiate with Pakistan some kind of arrangement whereby Pakistan can be part of a global restraint regime in on conditions that are acceptable to Pakistan.
This is going to have to be the last question.
Last week, please. You remember last time you promised me to be last question.
Keep your promise, Marvin. I will handle that quickly.
Yeah, I've been ordered here to keep my promise.
No. Requested, not ordered.
This is okay. No,
that,
we're recording, so we need to have...
Okay.
I know maybe for the...
Well, please make it short, please.
It's okay. So I know the room is still small, but everyone can hear me. I am from Pakistan, and Mr. Haqqani, ex-ambassador of Pakistan, thank you so much for coming here. And good afternoon, everyone. First of all, I say thank you to my son who worked in the World Bank, and he brought me here.
Sure.
Okay. My question is this, that would you please ask the weather today, weather gives you permission to come here and allow you, and the weather is agree for you. And my question is this, that what is your opinion about the Taliban, who are making a great trouble for the people of Pakistan?
Okay.
Thank you.
I think that's an easy one to answer. I think Taliban, whether in Pakistan or Afghanistan, are a threat to regional security, to people's way of life, and their worldview, in my opinion, is not acceptable in the 21st century. And I think that the Taliban needs to be confronted and marginalized. And unfortunately, there has been too much confusion in Pakistan. Pakistan will, at some point or the other, have to confront the Taliban, both of Pakistani origin and of Afghan origin. Any attempt to make distinctions between various factions of the Taliban will continue to keep Pakistan mired in this mess that Pakistan finds itself in, with Pakistanis being the victims of terrorism far more than nationals of any other country or of any of Pakistan's neighbors, or for that matter, the United States. So Pakistan really has to have a comprehensive strategy, put the Taliban out of business, all jihadi groups out of business, shut down Lashkar-e-Taiba, shut down Jaish-e-Mohammed, shut down Harkat-ul-Mujahideen, and come back to a situation where only the state has a monopoly over the use of power, rather than having all these extra state, non-state actors who can hold the state to ransom. Thank you all very much.
Well, let me say that although we could not have all the questions, our speaker is so loquacious that he covered so much ground that I'm sure we actually answered any number of questions out there. So you're going to be seated here.
Absolutely.
Now, and we welcome you to come up, and thank you again for coming.